What happened to our relationships during the pandemic? Today on The Curious Task, I speak with Rachel LaRose. Welcome to The Curious Task from the Institute for Liberal Studies, where we explore economics, politics, philosophy, and other ideas from a classical liberal perspective. I'm Alex Aragona, your host, and today I'm speaking with Rachel LaRose. Rachel graduated with a PhD in economics from George Mason University in 2022. She is a teaching professor in the Department of Economics at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio, and she currently teaches principles of macroeconomics and natural resource economics. Besides teaching courses at Xavier University, Rachel also works closely with the Smith Center at Xavier on political economy events on campus. Rachel, welcome to The Curious Task.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. I'm excited to be here.
And it's great to have you on. So we base each episode on a question and theme and go wherever the answers and conversation takes us. Our question and theme today is, what happened to our relationships during the pandemic? And really, that gives us a chance to focus on two main pillars of discussion that I sort of set up here. I want to talk about some of your work on commercial relationships during the pandemic, and then some interesting findings that you also had about Orthodox Jewish communities and so on and so forth. So I would like to start in the first place first, because I think that the commercial relationships during the pandemic work that you did is a good place to start. Mm. However, on a personal note, and I think this will also serve as some good context setting, I want to know what drew you to this specific topic personally, the commercial relationships. Obviously, like, you know, there was a pandemic that we all went through. So what happened during it is of interest to almost everybody. But beyond that, I'm curious to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, so I'm excited to chat about this. I think it's so important. So one thing that drew myself and my co-authors to our research on commercial relationships during the pandemic is that no one was really talking about commercial relationships. We were talking a lot about relationships in general and sentiments in general of being surviving lockdown, right? But there wasn't much discussion of what was happening with relationships that are formed because of the marketplace. And those are really important to focus on. That's commercial relationships are extremely meaningful and can provide many reasons for people to get together. And when those are closed, we should expect some serious consequences. So I'm happy to dive into that research if you'd like.
Yeah, we probably will. And a little further, I have some specific pillars I wanted to focus on. But before we do that, I did just want to elaborate on something you said right there. So you said that, like, you know, a lot of people are focusing on personal relationships, et cetera. Of course, during the pandemic, a lot of people just seem to take for granted that, of course, if, you know, some jurisdictions and so on and so forth brought in health regulations, lockdowns or whatever else, people understood that business as usual was going to be different. Do you think at a high level that people sort of took for granted that business as usual sort of just means goods exchanging rather than relationships as part of it?
Yes, I think that's a wonderful point. One of the big issues that we saw going into this research was that market spaces are not just for exchanging of goods. They are social arenas, even one-off interactions where you are out of town at a restaurant, right, meeting a waitress. That's a one-off interaction that's still social. But we also have a lot of important interactions in the market space that are not one-off and where our relationships are built. Think of our local diner where they know our orders for our Sunday brunch. I think of my hairdresser who, right, I get to chat with her and meet with her every few months. We catch up about our lives. It's not just an exchange. It's a meaningful relationship that's developed. It's not to say it's more or less meaningful than our familial ties or something like that. But it is to say that they're extremely important. And lacking those had detrimental effects during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And moving into some of the meat of the matter, then I thought that the paper that you co-authored was great, but I'm going to do something because I want to get to so much in our chat today. So I'm going to do something that I think you'll really appreciate. After I read through the paper, I did just go back to the abstract and say, okay, like if I wanted to talk about four key things with Rachel, what would they be? And it was effectively the four things outlined in the abstract. So because what I found interesting is that, you know, what happened is in the pandemic, as far as our commercial interactions and so on and so forth, I don't want to I'll leave it the value judgments and the sort of final conclusions to you. I don't want to jump to saying it's all negative per se, but it was interesting the things that changed. So I would like to go through that as listed sort of in the paper, because one of the things that was outlined, and then I'd like you to elaborate on, I'll toss over to you, is it was noted that the commercial interactions became more anonymous and less personalized. So you can explain that, what that means in and of itself in a more elaborated format, and also why that's important and why it may have negative consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the first of four, as you mentioned, the first four of our findings in this research is that commercial interactions became more anonymous and less personalized. One of the first things we point to here is work from home. And so that's not to say people don't enjoy work from home. I think people have adjusted to it and there's certainly benefits to it, but that's not to say there's not trade-offs. And I think that's the important point to emphasize. So we conducted a survey that this paper was drawing from, and we found over half of workers missed their colleagues. Many workers were unable to unplug because their workplace is also their home space. And of course, people adjust as time moves on. People have established home offices. If they've continued to work from home, people can adjust on multiple margins. But especially at the beginning of the pandemic, this anonymity really harmed coworkers. One of the things we actually found in our survey was that people missed the water cooler conversations. Mm-hmm. And those cannot be replicated very well on virtual technology, because these are water cooler conversations are the spontaneous. You just happen to be up from your desk and you chat with someone and you get to chatting. And before you know it, 5 or 10 minutes has gone by and you've just had a really enjoyable conversation with your coworker about some personal aspect in your life. And that is really hard to replicate on Zoom. So before I jump into the Zoom issue, because that's kind of getting to point two, I think a few more things that are important with commercial interactions becoming more anonymous and less personalized. Mm-hmm. Really, it's the lack of connection. And so it's not just the workplace where we see this. It's the leave at your front door options, those are all very normal to us now for grocery deliveries, Uber Eats, these sorts of things. But they actually were not a thing until the pandemic. I know it seems hard to remember back before 2020, but leave at my front door was not a common option offered. And now everything's dropped at your front door. You have no interaction whatsoever. I remember back before COVID, back in the days of yore, meeting my delivery drivers, getting to ask them how their day was. And now even I don't do that. And I recognize the detrimental effects I've lost. It's easier to just have it delivered. I could be doing something in my house and get the food from the front door when I'm able. Yep. And that's a connection that I'm missing. That's an experience with, it's not someone familial or close, but it's this experience that is nonetheless important to mental and psychological health when we connect with people. So the second point, if I may, jump to that one, and that's the work from home issue kind of translated into this idea that virtual platforms are imperfect substitutes for in-person connections. Mm-hmm. So this applies to remote workers. It also applies to a whole host of other people, which I can talk about. But so the water cooler conversations that I was mentioning earlier, those are really hard to replicate on Zoom because you are dropped into or whatever your Teams, whatever it may be. You're dropped into this virtual meeting room and there's no spontaneity there, right? It's right. A preset meeting. And you could ask, oh, how are you? I'm doing good. Nice to see you. But there's not any spontaneity or organic conversation that arises like would happen at a water cooler or in the break room. Mm-hmm. And that is really difficult to replicate. So another issue we see with working remotely when we're dropped into these remote spaces, like on Zoom or Teams, we have this inability to replicate the nonverbal cues we'd have in person. So we can send and receive nonverbal cues. And this whole term has been coined around the fatigue we feel when we are trying to send and receive nonverbal cues in this virtual environment. It's called Zoom fatigue. Psychologists have devoted lots of research to studying this, what's causing it. And one of the main thoughts is that it's this lack of ability to replicate a natural in-person conversation where, mm-hmm. I am intently trying to show you that I am listening to you in person. I don't have to go into such detail, or conscious behavior of showing you I'm listening to you. I want to make sure you hear me in a conversation. On Zoom, it's very important that I'm nodding, I'm signaling to you, yes, I'm with you. And I'm often looking at myself to see, am I showing the right cues to Alex to make sure he's hearing me and I'm hearing him? And so this mental load we take on actually leads to a lot of fatigue. But in addition to that, virtual platforms can really just be thought of as this imperfect substitute for in-person connections when we don't have in-person connections, when they're closed, like during COVID. So another example here would be dating apps. And so these are great. They are, of course, virtual platforms in which we meet people. They typically are complementary to in-person interaction, not substitutes for in-person interaction. So we chat with someone on a dating app and then we meet them at a bar. Or we meet them at a restaurant, or we meet them right in some commercial arena. When those were closed, we had no ability to translate the virtual into the in-person. And so that became a big barrier where virtual platforms, I'm not here to tell you they are horrible things. We know the efficient and wonderful things they've done for us. And they can be wonderful and they can be used as complements to in-person interaction. I mean, when used as substitutes for in-person interaction, you're lacking out, you're missing out on that in-person moment.
Yeah. And I think to sort of add to that point, if I may, but it'll go back to the commercial sphere in terms of, because I think it's sort of an interesting example to point out when people are just, you know, going to work or doing their regular routine. Like, let's say someone works in the private sector at a corporation, for example. I think a lot of people, in my experience, the way they've talked to me, at least, it's interesting to note that at the beginning, when everybody sort of went to go work at home, if they did work at an office previously, you know, their conscious part of their brain was sort of like, oh yeah, well now I can do the same work, quote unquote, at home. Great. But I think I've talked to a lot of people now who have certainly told me anecdotally that they didn't realize how much, and I don't mean this in a bad way, I mean in a good way, not work used to happen at work, whether it's the water cooler chat or it's the impromptu, hey, you know, we both want a bagel, let's go walk here for lunch together at the downtown core or whatever it was in these work environments. I think it's very interesting that moving all of this stuff, whether it's dating, a corporate work environment or all that kind of stuff, to a virtual platform, as you've said, it's very interesting that people sort of don't notice what's gone until it's gone, really. And it's really a bunch of subtle things that add up to richer communication, at least in my view. So I thought that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's right. The trade-offs are enormous. And oftentimes, you're right, they are not obvious until we kind of reflect and look back on what was.
Mm-hmm. Going further to your point, you said earlier that we talked about earlier, I should say, where that the commercial sphere is not just a place where just commerce happens, where someone buys something and someone receives it or sells it. I'd like to move us on as well to this is probably related, but it seems it's a separate pillar, of course. The main takeaway that individuals are spending more time interacting with closer ties rather than weaker ties. I think someone sight unseen, not reading your paper, just listening to that sentence I just read here, might think, well, what's the problem with that? Maybe during the pandemic, for example, a bunch of people spent more time with their family, whether virtually at the beginning or maybe when they could see each other again, even more time with their family after. What's wrong, or what is the impact of spending more time with closer ties rather than weaker ties?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the close versus weak ties is coming from a very famous economic sociologist, Mark Granovetter. And he argues, the title of his paper is The Strength of Weak Ties. And similarly to you, when I first read this paper, I was very taken aback. I was like, well, my family is the most important thing. Why would a weak tie or a weak connection matter? But it turns out, as Granovetter discusses in the paper, weak ties, meaning our more distant connections, they are those who bring information into our networks. They bridge us to new groups. They bridge us to job opportunities. They bridge us to new people, new networking arenas, all sorts of opportunities, all sorts of new information. Whereas our close ties, think of family and close friends here, they are already within our network. And it's uncommon for them to bring new information into our network, like a job opportunity, for instance, because you kind of know everything they kind of know. It's not perfect, but there's a lot of overlap between your shared knowledge. And so there is a huge strength of weak ties insofar as you can learn new things from them, learn new people, learn about new opportunities. They bring new information into your network. And so the big problem comes when during lockdowns, we are spending time with our immediate family members. They are who we're locked down with, or they're who you're FaceTiming every day if you don't live with them. But it's your weak ties, maybe that colleague that you talk to once a week or once every couple weeks, or someone that you, a neighbor or someone like that, that again is more of this distant relation. It's those who we're missing out on the conversations with. One example I think that really highlights why this could be a problem are students, college students, high school students who really rely on networking and their weak ties to get jobs, to find new information, to learn new opportunities. If they are relying now on their parents and their siblings for that, they've got a lot less information entering their network. They're also, notice for younger kids, the problem becomes they're learning less socialization skills when they're not connecting with peers outside of their usual family unit. So this to me is perhaps the most important thing we talk about the paper, because as you say, it's unintuitive to think about weak ties being extremely important, but they really are. And without them, during the pandemic, students, worker, like everyone from 90 down to 9 months old, right? They're missing out on these weak ties that bring in new information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I often think of, I have a few friends, for example, that, you know, they work in specific trades, and that's not what I do professionally or vocationally. I'm mostly doing business stuff and stuff with the ILS and so on and so forth. I don't like using the dichotomy that much, but you know, white collar, blue collar type stuff. And one of my best friends from childhood, you know, I find that, so he's in the auto body trade, and I find that these folks, I never thought of it with this language till I read your paper. They have tons of weak ties, and they are the most interesting things, because if someone has to change a dog, it's, oh no, Pat knows Stan knows Bob, who might be able to introduce me to like, you know, Jennifer or whatever, who might have a job for me. Like, these networks, although weak, like, they'd never have a beer with these people, they'd never, you know, for instance, consider them even friends in some cases. But like, it's interesting that commercially, like, these networks are actually often very strong in some professions. I've heard anecdotally some of them weakened during the pandemic, but I think it's sort of a good example. As soon as I read the paper, that's one of the things that struck me from a purely professional perspective. Even some industries have a whole abundance of weak ties that seem to make them stronger. So I thought that was an interesting example I thought of, but I just thought to share that.
No, that's great. Yeah, thank you. That's a wonderful example to highlight the issue.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to keep us moving in the interest to close off the four pillars here in the interest of time. The idea that commercial setting is less likely to serve as social arenas, I think we've touched on this as we've gone along, but just to put sort of more of a button on it, I was wondering if you could elaborate on that one too.
Yeah, so commercial settings, as we've mentioned, are not just for our trading, buying and selling. They're also where social interactions occur. And so there, I think it's probably the most obvious but important of the points that we make, because these simply became non-existent in many places for months on end. These commercial settings became, like I said, non-existent. So I have some data to share. So at some point during the pandemic, 46 states had stay-at-home orders. All 50 states at one point had school closures. And 48 states closed bars and restaurants. For at least some period of time, closed, right? I'm not talking about 50% capacity, which right. We know followed these closures, and 50% right. Capacities even have their own problems of restricting how many people can gather. But total closures, total stay-at-home orders of schools, bars, and restaurants. This is, I think, speaking to all the points that we've now touched on. I mean, again, we're spending more time with our close ties, less with weak ties. We are now interacting on virtual platforms where we can't communicate as well, and have a harder time not just communicating, but communicating socially and having these spontaneous and organic interactions. And we've become, during these times, all services became more anonymous, whether it was getting right. your food, if you were out in public wearing a mask, making it harder to read verbal cues and interact and smile with a stranger. So I think this final point in our paper kind of buttresses the previous 3 points that when these places are closed, these are the consequences we face.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, I guess, how do I phrase this correctly? I guess, let's say during the pandemic, like the main thrust of it, because I think most or all would agree that we're certainly away from that, you know, once more than once removed at this point. But let's say during the main throes of the pandemic, I think everyone would agree there was effects on their life personally, either economically, maybe they lost a job or something like that. Or, you know, socially, I think people, whether it was Zoom fatigue or whatever else, were reporting that lockdowns, restrictions, etc. Everybody wanted to get back to normal. I know listening to radio and other sources, there were some, I shouldn't say everybody, because there were some folks that in my value judgment was sounding a little off, saying that they'd rather stay in lockdown till the whole thing gets completely squashed. And I will have no problem saying my value judgment is that's definitely off from what I think was appropriate. But I almost everyone wanted to get back to some sort of normal. Now that we're, let's say, on the upswing of heading toward whatever the new normal is going to be. So outside of the idea of us just talking about what the impacts were during the pandemic, in your sort of judgment or your thumb on the pulse or however you want to take that, are you concerned that all of the sorts of things we just talked about are going to continue to some degree? That is to say that these impacts during the pandemic are going to be lingering, almost like a long COVID of problems with commerce, if you will, past the pandemic. I know no one can predict the future, but even if it's just anecdotal, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about how great your concern is moving forward with everything we just talked about.
Yeah, my concern is, I'm fairly concerned, I'll put it that way. I don't think we're anywhere at the degree that we were in March, April, May of 2020. But I do think some of the issues we've talked about, coupled with, I think, the compelling evidence on the loneliness epidemic, I think whatever's driving that, I've seen lots of different scholars debating this. I'm not here to claim there's one driver. One of the more compelling discussions I've heard on this is it's the social media driving the loneliness epidemic. Again, that's debated, but I do think the loneliness epidemic coupled with some of these issues that are still here post pandemic are cause for concern. In particular, a lot of the continued work from home, a lot of the continued delivery options that are leave at my front door, and I actually think there's some basis for these concerns. So post Spanish influenza in 1918. There are some researchers that looked into what happened to social norms following that, and they find that there's a decrease in trust. Now, it's a very broad general study. Decrease in trust is hard to measure, but they do find, especially in countries that had open, honest media where people could get the truth of what was happening, which was extremely devastating with hundreds of thousands of people dying, those places had less trust because people stayed away from each other. They had complete information. They knew if I go near people, there's a chance I catch this influenza and I die. And so people had a lot of mistrust, and did not want to be near others. And so I think you saw a lot of the close versus weak tie issue going on back then, where let me stay locked down with my immediate family. I don't trust those outside of this circle, that sort of thing. So I think there is some empirical, historical evidence that these types of concerns could remain. This is all, of course, and like you said, we can't predict the future. But as a college professor, I see it. So my students were ending middle school, beginning high school during COVID, and they're now college students. And many of them don't speak with each other before class. And so getting to the anecdotal part of it, I'm not sure that they have many, many connections besides their immediate family. They don't speak much to each other before class. When I try and get them to do group work, they're hesitant. When I assign them group projects, they have a hard time exchanging contact information. And that wasn't my college experience at all. And I don't think it's...
Mine neither.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's through no fault of their own, but they have a very hard time interacting. And so I do worry about this.
Mm-hmm. And let me see if I can connect a couple dots here to get to my next question for you. And you tell me if I'm making any sense or if I need to clarify further. But it seems to me, whether it's the example of colleges and university, and I certainly don't want to make higher education experience sound like it's a strict commercial interaction, because that's certainly not my view of the value of higher education. But it is interesting to know, you know, people are paying tuition, they're purchasing courses and professor time and so on and so forth from that strict perspective, or whether it's, you know, the leave at the door thing we talked about or whatever else. I sort of feel like an underlying theme of everything we've talked about, including the anecdotal stuff you just brought up, is that we're losing a lot of rich interaction and value from that interaction, whether it's trust or people feel more polarized or whatever else, when people feel that they are sort of, I guess, how do I explain this, reacting or living with an economy rather than being a participant in it, if you see what I'm saying. It seems that like a lot of people, you know, you're participating by purchasing a course, but you're not participating as part of the student body, for example, or you're participating at work by doing your job, but you're not participating in any workplace culture kind of thing. I think this is a little bit me grasping at my own sort of pet thought in my head, but it seems to me a lot of this just sort of means people are sort of just doing the bare bones of interaction in an economy when it comes to exchange, rather than any of the sort of stuff that was implied before, like you said, an interaction, some small talk with the store owner you went to or whatever else. If we strip away all that stuff, maybe that does. I know we're all speculating here just for sake of conversation, but to me, it almost seems like that certainly would contribute to decreased trust, political polarization that everyone's talking to, all this kind of stuff. If you feel like there's always someone external to you outside of your own bubble, either causing a problem or someone you can't trust, I mean, no wonder we're facing some of the current social, cultural issues that a lot of people are also lamenting about. Anyway, I was not sure if you wanted to riff off that or you had any thoughts to add, but that's sort of what comes to mind here as well, is that to strip commerce and human interaction down to its bare bones is kind of problematic from a healthy cultural perspective, at least in my view. That's where my intuition takes me.
I absolutely agree it is problematic. And most of economics has studied the marketplace as this anonymous place of exchange. And that's simply not what it is, or at least what it was and what it still to some extent is today. I don't mean to be some doom and gloom guest on the podcast. I do think when you strip away the cultural and social and organic interactions in a marketplace, you are left with this anonymous arena of buying and selling. And again, the loneliness epidemic has so many causal factors. It's too much to discuss here. We'd need a few days of podcast length, but it's got to be one of the driving factors where you strip all of that important stuff out. And I think be fair to the other side, right? That there is a lot of benefits from work from home, right? People now can change their laundry, do their dishes, and these sorts of things when they're on break. And that's great. I do think there's a lot of benefits from Zoom. Again, we're meeting on a virtual platform, and that's wonderful that this technology has brought us together. So I'm trying to steer clear, and I think most economists try and steer clear from strictly normative or opinion-based reasoning, and trying to look at it more so of the fact that there are trade-offs. And so there are enormous benefits of work from home and Zoom and these sorts of technologies. There's also costs when we switch to those. And it's just important to look at the costs. And I think that was something when we wrote this paper, that was something really missing from the dialogue were the trade-offs associated with these changes to our behavior.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I want to ask sort of one more question before we head to the break, but that question about trade-offs and so on and so forth, I sort of want to ask you this because it's great to have someone, an economist like talk about this sort of thing, because I think some folks, they think, and it's an incorrect perception that all economists focus on is like sort of material richness and so on and sort of the hardcore sort of commerce and exchange part you were just talking about. But you sort of philosophically or sort of in your own value judgments that I want to hear your thought on, like, what I'm about to ask, which is, you know, do you think an extremely materially rich world also comes with its own opportunity costs of all the kinds of things you're saying? That is to say, I'm not saying you have to have one or the other, but I'm saying you can sort of picture a world where we lower so many transaction costs drastically. You know, we have everything left at the door. We don't even have to leave our house and, you know, get it, you know, use different devices, which are known as cars, to get anywhere. You know, there's no lost time in between our Zoom meetings. We can sort of efficiently work between calendar items. People can teach from home. It's like, when you sort of look at this hyper efficient world that, you know, could in theory bring us material riches, I see a lot of people sort of focusing on that end of the equation, whether it's from the green angle of, like, you know, how much carbon we're not blowing into atmosphere by going around, or some other economists I've seen really focus on how in other ways transaction costs and certain, you know, productivity can theoretically go up during all this sort of thing. But are there costs and you're already getting into this point, but I want to elaborate further. It seems to me there's huge opportunity cost to that in other ways, whether it's socially, culturally, or the other richer things we can be rich with in human life, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point. That old aphorism that sticks around from childhood, stop and smell the roses. There's something to that. Of course, we're social scientists, so we want to dig deeper than that. But I do think there's something to that at the heart of marketplace interactions and in general, just a market-based society. The more efficient you get, there certainly are trade-offs. And so I don't know if there is some appropriate balance between efficiency and leisure, or efficiency and social time. And I think that's different for everyone, which is what makes it tough to really comment on when should we stop becoming more efficient or something like that. And so I wonder if that's also the strength of becoming more efficient, is that it frees up time for us to have more social interactions and enjoyable experiences. I wonder if the more we advance, maybe the more time we have to enjoy experiences.
Great. All right. Well, with that, it's about time to take our break. So we're going to do that right now. Everyone, you're listening to Curious Task. I'm speaking with Rachel LaRose today. The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions, feedback, guest recommendations, or anything else that's on your mind to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. As always, a huge thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Randy T. Simmons, Travis Smith, and John Robson. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @TheCuriousTask, rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to The Curious Task, and check out the Institute for Liberal Studies. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Rachel LaRose today. So, Rachel, I think the first half was great. We sort of talked pretty much all about one of the main things that one of your co-authored papers talks about, which was effectively what happened during the pandemic as far as commercial interactions and relationships and so on and so forth. I want to do a bit of a gear shift here. Now, those who haven't read your papers and are enjoying the ride with us on the podcast might think this is going to come from a different weird angle, but I hope everybody hears the relations and sees where we're going with that as we go here, because a good chunk of your other work and your recent work sort of focusing on stories and findings about Orthodox Jewish communities during the pandemic and how they handled certain community challenges and so on and so forth. Before I get into some specific questions, I just wanted to just hand it over to you to sort of set the stage for not only what was literally happening during the COVID-19 pandemic as far as certain regulations or certain things beyond the fact the pandemic was happening that some of these Orthodox Jewish communities had to deal with, and sort of describe a little bit about these sorts of communities, you know, their close-knit ties, newspapers, commerce, et cetera, like sort of paint the whole context of what I'm going to be asking you questions about. Because I don't think me just saying Orthodox Jewish communities during the pandemic is sort of enough. Like, I think some people who aren't familiar with this might need a bit more context. I think I'd just like to throw it to you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So my co-authors and I, we are researching what happened to Orthodox Jewish communities during the pandemic. And so just a bit about Orthodox Jewish communities themselves. So we're focusing in New York City. There's some difference between Orthodox communities throughout the world in Israel versus New York, but they're pretty small. And in particular, I want to emphasize we're focusing on ultra-Orthodox communities. And so ultra-Orthodox communities tend to be more insular than Orthodox communities, meaning they mostly are interacting with members of their own community. They are more separated from secular society. They have a large emphasis on communal life. Halakha is this tenet that God is in every aspect of life. So if you've heard of like kosher rules, you can't have pork, right? No mixing meat and dairy, this sort of thing. Those rules are part of halakha, which is God is in every aspect of life, our food, our education, our community. And so religion is extremely important, of course, no doubt, to the ultra-Orthodox community. Rabbinic authority is also a big thing in this community. That means that the rabbi and rabbinic councils have ultimate authority over many things, including weddings and the type of food you can eat, these sorts of decisions in your life. Also present in the community is daily or multi-daily prayer. Tefillah is the term here. And this is this prayer requires what we call a minyan or a quorum. And so here's where you can see maybe some tension with COVID coming in is this quorum needs to be in ultra-Orthodox communities, 10 men, in Reform communities, 10 people. But they all have to be there. And for certain high holidays, like the end of Yom Kippur, for instance, you need 30 men present. And so you can begin to see very quickly, we've got communal life, we've got lots of gathering. You can see right away, right, clashes when COVID hits, the communal life and lots of people gathering for religious events. It's not going to jive well, which we know it didn't. There was lots of issues going on. So about the issues happening during COVID, here's what, of course, what we were all facing, but Orthodox communities in particular had to face. So synagogues were closed down, schools, particularly religious schools, yeshivas were closed. Orthodox Jewish communities in the New York City area were often put into what we call red zones. And they weren't specifically targeted at Orthodox Jewish communities, or so the politicians said, but because there were more gatherings happening within those communities, that's where we were dubbing red zones. So red zones meant even further restrictions on schools, closed for longer periods of time, businesses closed, even restricted travel in and out of those areas. There were gathering restrictions, 10 people or less, through most of the pandemic, which meant for high holidays, the quorum could not be met. Distance had to be kept, masks had to be on, which made all of this gathering, all of the community events, funerals, weddings, all of these things that require lots of people there religiously were extremely difficult. So I hope that gives good background to listeners. But I think the general takeaway is this community is extremely communal, And these were hampered during the pandemic from all of these different rules we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. No, and that was excellent context. I think that provides the perfect pathway into some of the follow-up questions I want to ask. And then I think, you know, I'll just mention before I get into some of those follow-up questions that I think a lot of people, of course, not everybody, sort of felt and assumed that during the pandemic, you know, the best way for people to go about their business was to sort of listen to a health authority or whatever the government was saying at the time, not only because it was the right thing to do for public health reasons, but a lot of people also felt the only solutions to certain things could come from, you know, the state actors or whoever in place of this. It seems that this story and what you've uncovered about Orthodox Jewish communities during the pandemic certainly should at the very least give people pause on that train of thought that only the state can help things go along. So I sort of did, because there's so much we could talk about, but for the sake of time and to make sure to get all of it, I sort of did what I did with the first half of the conversation, which is I sort of pulled what I think were sort of the main pillars of what we could talk about here as far as what Orthodox Jewish communities did. So I like to tour through them. And obviously you can provide the nuance. So the first one was noted, quote, "Rabbis acted as institutions to help advise their community during the pandemic on how to stay healthy." So already here, can you explain how rabbis effectively acted as almost like a public health advisory or authority in that way? That's very interesting.
It is really interesting. And we argue that, I shouldn't even say argue, the evidence we find is pretty overwhelming that rabbis, by and large, supported the public health measures, but they acted as this important pillar in the community, right? There's rabbinic authority, and so we listen to the rabbi as kind of the thought in ultra-Orthodox communities. And they were pillars that were translating, literally translating, if Orthodox Jewish community members didn't speak English, but also translating the nuance and the rules and restrictions to their community members, encouraging them. There's this tenet in Judaism called pikuach nefesh, and that emphasizes, it roughly translates to saving a life. And saving a life here, what rabbis meant when they were calling on this was, and what this tenet means, is that when in contention, we should place saving a life above following religious rules and rituals. That comes before all else. And rabbis were repeating that message across all different synagogues in the New York City area and the New Jersey area. We have statements that they've released that we found through our research. And nearly every statement said, we have to place saving lives and caring for our community members above religious obligations. And so what did they do to facilitate this? Well, again, they sent out messages to their congregants. They also transitioned services to Zoom. Again, there's imperfect, as we've talked about, it's an imperfect transition to Zoom. But it was something to keep the community together. If imperfect, at least it was something. Some events were halted, like events that included eating so that people could keep masks on, but they could still gather. Rabbis were finding these ways to tinker, to find ways around, we just can't gather at all. And that's important. Maybe this is a good time to mention actually the framing of the paper before we dive into the other tenets. This is, I think, really important to emphasize this difference between technical and economic problems. So technical problems, it's solving one end. It's getting to one end with whatever means you've got available. So the classic example is put man on the moon. What did we do? We devoted tons of resources, money, right, manpower, all of this to get man on the moon.
Right.
Economic problems, however, ask the question, what should our end be? We've got some means. How should we allocate our scarce means among all of the ends possible? Should we get man to the moon? Should we fund some other program? Should we have 18 other things we could do? And these problems, we're all solving economic problems every day. Should I spend my time on X or Y? Should I read this book or that book? All of these different questions you ask yourself daily, we're solving economic problems.
Right.
And so that is what we find the Orthodox Jewish community was doing during COVID was solving economic problems, whereas public health authorities were solving technical problems. The technical problem they faced was keep case rates low, right? Keep case rates low, keep death counts low, keep people in their homes. These have massive trade-offs. Not to say those aren't extremely important goals, because of course we want people healthy and alive. But right. we have to, again, back to what we were discussing before the break, we have to acknowledge trade-offs. And so what rabbis were doing, back to this first point in our paper, they were solving economic problems. They realized we can't spend our whole life locked in our home, especially given the obligations of our religion and the importance of our religion in our life. And mm-hmm. so let's find ways to meet several ends meaning to still have our religion, which is so important, to still practice and worship that religion, to also maintain health. They found incredible, incredible solutions to what we were facing, economic problems rather than technical problems. Mm-hmm. So I hope that framing makes sense, but I think it's just so important. It illuminates really all of what was happening, I think, during the pandemic between government agencies acting to solve technical problems versus communities acting to try and address these problems with economic solutions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that distinction is excellent. And thank you for going through that. And it's also interesting to note as well that I think that, you know, like you're saying, the sort of technical problem or the public health problem as it was framed during the pandemic. I mean, there's a pandemic. We want to get rid of it. We want case numbers to be low was the mentality. We don't want people to get this anymore. Let's, you know, at the end of the day, the ideal was to get rid of COVID-19, right? And it seems to me, at least, that if there was a story that popped up, and I do remember them during the pandemic, whether it's a religious community trying to do things a different way or not necessarily following every rule to the T, or even someone use a bastion of the community trying to keep their restaurant open for whatever reason during that. In many cases, although it wasn't outright said, it seemed that there was this sort of implication by either the state or the media or whatever else that, hey, we're all in this together. These people are sort of stepping out of line, frankly. But it's interesting that your research and your sort of even just what we talked about so far, and we're going to get into more in a second. But I just like to take a pause here and note that I like that distinction you made, because it really shows that what you found is that there's nuances here. It's not that you either cared or you didn't about the pandemic. In this case, you have a bunch of research that shows these folks did very much care about health and, of course, don't want to see in their people in their community sick. But they sort of figure out ways to organize themselves to do both as much as they could, or at least weigh trade-offs. So I just thought that was an interesting comment as well, because this is all within the context, and some people might even forget now. They've either put it out of their head or they were too busy at the time to think about. But there was also a lot of social and cultural pressure at that time, too, to just simply fall in line and frankly, be quiet and do what the public health authorities said. But there are some nuances there. So
that's right. Absolutely, there are nuances. And people are rational. They value multiple ends. And I don't know if it's fair to call people who value multiple ends irrational or crazy or not falling in line. Because for some communities, and I think this probably holds for everyone, there are other things important to us than just having one margin of health met, which is not getting COVID. For instance, I mean, we could even put aside religion. Let's talk about mental health when we're locked down. Right. Sure, we're fulfilling one margin of health, which is I'm not getting COVID, but what's happening to my mental health or my physical health if I can't exercise, right? I'm trapped in a small apartment or something like that. I mean, there's so much nuance, and it's a shame that nuance was largely ignored during the pandemic. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a nice segue into the next one I want to bring up, because it's another part of your research here, because I think someone listening to us so far that might be that perhaps, and I'm obviously making up a fake person in my head just for the sake of discussion, but who might say like, okay, that's all great. We can provide advice and we can find out ways to still run our communities or so on and so forth. And there are trade-offs, but it's not like, you know, a sort of bottom-up sort of community-based solutions can do everything that the state does. They might provide advice, but they might not be able to provide some types of services, which brings me to the next one, which I found was very interesting when I read it, which is, quote, private Jewish ambulatory services provided religiously sensitive health care during the pandemic. So here we're not just talking about advice, we're talking about actual health care. And then I'll bundle that with the next one as well, which was also the note that there were, you know, health services, public health services at Orthodox Jewish schools privately provided, such as like testing, tracing, and so on and so forth. So this was kind of interesting too, because this moves beyond the realm, as I was saying before, of communities trying to get together and continue you know, whatever communal activities they're doing. This is sort of gets into interesting territory of certain communities providing public health services.
Yes, that's right. And it's quite incredible. For those who aren't familiar with what Jewish communities have been up to, the provision of public health services. So, I mean, first of all, they're incredible institutions that exist. But so private Jewish ambulatory services in particular, Hatzalah, they've been present in New York City since the 1960s. And they exist in, there's chapters all over the world of Hatzalah. But again, we're focusing on New York City in our research. So in New York City alone, there's 9 chapters of these ambulatory services, but there's tons of divisions within each of those chapters. So we're talking about a really large network. They took thousands and thousands of calls during the pandemic. And what they do is exactly what you've stated. They provide this culturally and religiously sensitive healthcare. So to be treated medically, there are perhaps different customs or rules you'd like to be followed as an Orthodox Jewish community member that might be different from just a regular old secular person or something like that. So it's extremely important, not just because they were receiving this culturally and religiously sensitive healthcare, but also because it's alleviating strain on the greater healthcare system. And I think that's also important to point out. Mm. Another really fascinating thing that happened during COVID was an all-women's unit of these Hatzalah opened. They actually were unable to open for years, could not get the permit through the city in New York. And finally, during COVID, it was approved. And so this even furthered the ability for women in particular, Orthodox women in particular, to receive this sensitive healthcare. Not only were they just providing healthcare in terms of we're going to send an ambulance and treat you, they were also issuing guidance throughout the pandemic, talking with community members, you know, how could you stay safe during the holidays? What types of practices should you be taking into your household and adopting? And so they were providing not just incredible healthcare, but also guidance, which like from right medically trained doctors who are religiously sensitive. They're not doctors at a hospital that tell you, well, you need to stay home, you need to mask and you can't see anyone, right? That sort of thing. They actually understand what ultra-Orthodox communities were facing. And so they were able to then give them not just religiously sensitive care, but also guidance and advice on how they should adapt to COVID given the community in which they live. Similarly, schools, so private Jewish schools were providing public health services. And we've seen a lot in the news, perhaps you've seen this during COVID, of schools that got a lot of pushback and hate from politicians and those in the community. Why aren't you closed? Why aren't you doing more? Again, I think it's important to emphasize here that people value multiple ends, not just one end of physical health from COVID, but also mental health, other types of physical health, religion, education. And so schools, by and large, even when they were told to close, and this is where a lot of controversy came in, these private Jewish day schools, some of them did not close. And what they were doing instead, they were actually insisting every student was tested daily. Students who would not let, excuse me, parents who would not let their students, their kids be tested, were not allowed to have their kids at school. So the schools were extremely rigid. And if we are going to keep these places open, which we value for your children, we're going to abide by some pretty serious rules. And that is, again, testing each kid, making sure that they're not infected. And if they won't be tested, they cannot come. That's really interesting. They also socially sanctioned families who they knew like traveled to big weddings. So this was another story we saw at the time, right? That Orthodox communities were still holding big weddings and funerals. When schools caught wind of this, if they knew someone at their school had attended that event, they said, "I'm sorry, but you can't come in for the next, you know, however many days." So they were extremely rigid, and they weren't being rigid for no reason. In fact, we have statements that these schools released. They did all of this because at the end of the day, what they say is, we do not want to close the schools.
Right.
we understand this end of education is an important end to you. And so if you'd like to remain open, we have to follow these important guidelines rather than just, right, willy-nilly, let's keep the school open, do nothing, or the other extreme end, let's close and have no in-person connection or education. They found this really, helpful middle ground that was able to value multiple ends. That's where that solving an economic problem kind of thought comes in, where they're trying to solve that end of, okay, we care about not being infected with COVID. We also care about religious education. We care about students having social interaction with peers, right? They're solving all of these ends rather than just one. And that's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. No, that is incredible. Thank you for chewing through that. We hit pretty much everything that I wanted to talk about as far as specifics and the things we'll have time for to talk about today. And I'd like to move just to a couple more general questions. Our time is pretty much on its final swing here, but I have a couple more questions before our final wrap up. And just one of them is sort of just at the end of the day, really me wanting to zoom out a bit and throw it to you for an opportunity to sort of put a button on it. But basically, like in everything we just talked about, like what do you think, you know, we can learn from this specific example about, you know, communities sort of, you know, frankly, governing themselves, working on solutions themselves, this whole notion that we often hear about and I've talked about with certain guests on the podcast of the idea of the bottom up versus top down solutions, whether it's sort of command and control from the state or specific, as you sort of put it, a state or a top down actor, even like a corporation trying to solve a problem from a technical perspective versus communities organizing themselves. I know that's a lot that we can unpack there and a lot of nuance there, but I just thought from that sort of perspective, if you want to riff off that or add anything about if there's a general lesson about the sort of bottom-up approach that we can learn from this and take away.
Absolutely. The first thought that comes to mind is that public health policies from the top down are at best thoughtless and at worst dangerous when they don't incorporate local community members' knowledge. I say thoughtless at best because if you're going to implement a policy that has absolutely no bearing or relevance or extremely hinders, for instance, a community, they're unlikely to follow it. And so closing a synagogue or telling Orthodox Jewish community members you can't celebrate Yom Kippur, that's just thoughtless insofar like they're going to, that's an extremely important part of their identity. They're not just going to say, okay, maybe next year we can get back to it. Mm-hmm. And I say dangerous at worst, because when you mesh this top-down policy with enforcement, things could get dangerous very quickly. And thankfully, during COVID, we didn't, at least in the United States, there were no awful, dangerous outcomes that occurred in Orthodox Jewish communities. But there were policemen stationed outside of synagogues. And that's not dangerous per se, but it could have turned dangerous very quickly. I think we could envision a more autocratic government. In fact, we don't have to envision. We saw what was happening, for instance, in China, where there was absolutely no say from community members. And people did get in trouble if they stepped outside the line. Mm-hmm. And so, thankfully, that wasn't a rampant issue in the United States where there was no danger. But I think there was a lot of thoughtlessness. And it ought to inform future policymaking. I'm sure everyone who's ever talked about community governance, including Eleanor Ostrom, who we could discuss if you want. I don't know if there's time, but whenever community governance comes up, it's hard not to stress how past policymaking in almost every realm has ignored community input and how, again, thoughtless or perhaps dangerous that can become. Because communities have the strongest incentive to get it right. They are the stakeholders. It's their lives. They don't want to die from COVID just as much as the government doesn't want them to, but they also value other things. And that is, I think, the important point.
Mm-hmm. And yes, our time is pretty much winding down here, but you mentioned Eleanor Ostrom, and I did want to, if we could talk about her, I did want to see if we could today. So I'll make sure we don't leave the conversation today without stopping to ask you for a bit more context on some of her works and also basically how that main line of her work connects to your thoughts and the things we discussed today. And again, you know, credit to obviously yourself and Eleanor Ostrom. We can't summarize all of that kind of question. We'll probably need a whole other podcast, which I'm more than happy to do if you are. But having said that, you know, sort of your top level sort of pitch and thoughts before we head to the formal wrap up, you did mention Eleanor Ostrom. So how do you think the main line of that connects into what you're talking about here? Do we learn more about, at least through Orthodox Jewish communities, governing the commons today? Or what's the thought you want to leave people with on Eleanor Ostrom?
So I am truly standing on the shoulders of giants. Eleanor Ostrom, so she's an incredible economist. She won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009. She actually has a poli-sci PhD because she was not allowed into an econ program, just for your listeners if they're interested. But she went ahead and won the econ Nobel Prize anyway, which is just incredible. So Ostrom, really what made her famous, her research was on this third way of governing common pool resources. So common pool resources, for your listeners, those are rival but non-excludable resources. So think of a lake that nobody owns that has fish in it. It's rival insofar as when I take a fish, that's one less fish you could take. It's non-excludable insofar as anyone could come to that lake and fish. It's a commons. And so this quickly leads to what we call the tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy because all the fish get taken very quickly and we're all left hungry, right? No fish left. And so the common thoughts on how could we govern these sorts of resources is, well, we could give private ownership. So now maybe it's only Alex can own that lake. No one else can enter unless Alex allows them. Maybe they have to pay a fee to enter, but it's Alex's lake. Or there's government ownership or government control. That's the second way that's often proposed, is if the government just manages that lake, then they'll keep everyone out and maybe they'll allow seasonal fishing or something like that. But that's another solution. And so the thought is, if we don't have one of those two in place, then it will become a tragedy of the commons. And Eleanor Ostrom got out of her right chair, got out of the ivory tower and said, what's actually happening in communities that have common pool resources, but don't have property rights formally, and also don't have government managing the resource? And she found communities, by and large, can govern resources. It's not perfect, not in every case, but they can govern themselves and govern resources without a tragedy of the commons occurring. They have informal measures to, for instance, monitor how many people fish every day, how big of a fish you can take, right? These sorts of rules. They have sanctioning systems to punish those who take too many fish or something like that. And communities were doing this by themselves. Again, back to the point that communities, individuals living in these places, they are the ones who have an incentive to get it right because it's their life. It's their life. And so that's extremely powerful. So her research connects to what we're up to in huge ways, mostly in the fact that we're studying an instance in which communities are governing themselves successfully. And when we try and impose some outside solution of, for instance, government control, you are squashing out what communities have already been doing to try and solve this problem. And so really, we're privileged to be working from Eleanor Ostrom's thoughts in our paper, because she is kind of the foundational thinker here of community governance, and that communities really have this incentive. They're the ones with the biggest motivation to get it right because it's their livelihood.
Excellent. No, thank you for that. And I think without having an hour or so to get into it, which I'm sure it could certainly get into, I think that was an excellent way of putting it. And that takes us right to the end of our time. I am going to move us to our formal wrap up. Rachel, and each guest, I want the guest to ultimately have the last word and bring the conversation full circle and put a finer point on our exploration of the main theme in question. So let me ask you officially then, what do you hope are the main takeaways for someone listening to you here on what happened to our relationships, the relationship of others during the pandemic, like Orthodox Jewish communities? In other words, if you wanted someone to leave this conversation we had today with just one, two, or a few takeaways, if anything, what do you hope they do take away?
Thank you for that. So two important takeaways. First is there's trade-offs to any action we take. That's Econ 101, but it's important to emphasize when we're dealing with something as large as a pandemic. There's trade-offs to deciding to work from home. There's trade-offs to stay-at-home orders. And what you're trading off might not seem obvious until you've reflected on the fact that I'm really missing my community. I'm really missing my workplace. I'm really lacking on certain social areas. And so that is, for all listeners, please always think about the trade-offs of any action you take, because there are unforeseen or unseen costs that matter. So I think that's one is to, even if we're happy with or okay with work from home and okay with Zoom rather than in-person meetings, we have to acknowledge the trade-offs. Because they're there and they're present and they have costs in our lives. The second takeaway is, I think, community governance, especially during disasters. There's a huge, rich literature in this area that I couldn't do justice in the wrap-up, but I'm not the only one. My co-authors and I aren't the only ones writing about communities governing themselves during disasters. It's been research after Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy. The communities actually, again, are the ones that step up because it's their life. They have the incentive to make sure they recover and have the incentive to make sure they meet the ends that they desire. And we should not undercount or discredit the huge role that communities can play in recovery. And when I say we, I mean a couple people. First, the government shouldn't discredit the role that communities can play in recovery. Especially, again, coming back to our discussion on COVID, Orthodox Jewish communities were instrumental in recovering from the pandemic, helping their community thrive. And also we, not just the government, but when I say we, I also mean we should think more highly of these communities. I just mean the general public. Back to your point earlier, Alex, that communities, there's nuance to this. We value more than one end, and it's not just people are either bad or good. People value multiple ends in their life. And I think that's something we should all step back and appreciate, that people have different lives than us and have different preferences, and they are trying to meet their ends as best they can. I think those are two important takeaways.
Great. I think that's an excellent place to leave it. So, Rachel LaRose, thank you very much for joining me on The Curious Task today.
Thank you, Alex. Have a good day.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Alex Aragona, Sabine Elchidiak, and Eric Segain. Our executive producer is Matt Bufton. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Voppenfjord. You should check out his other stuff online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it and listeners like yourself. Check us out on Patreon and find out how you can support us and get access to exclusive offers. I'm Alex Aragona, and thank you very much for joining us on The Curious Task. Bye-bye.